Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Daniel Ellsberg, whatever his intentions, gave aid and comfort to the enemy. And under those circumstances, that is inexcusable. After all, he is putting himself above the President of the United States, above the Congress, above our whole system of government, when he says, in effect, that he would determine what should be made public.
The dulcet tones of President Richard Nixon discussing Daniel Ellsberg's decision to leak the Pentagon Papers and dramatically alter the United States' relationship to the war in Vietnam. That means that Richard Nixon, as part of the film The Most Dangerous Man in America, Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers, has just kicked off a four-part series that we will be doing now through Thursday, highlighting the films nominated for the Best Documentary in this Sunday's Oscars. Let everybody else talk about Avatar. We're going to focus on the documentaries all this week nominated for Best Documentary in the Oscars, and that's one of the things that we think makes us different. And for many of our listeners, the story of Dr. Daniel Ellsberg is a familiar one, a cold warrior turned peace activist. He was directly responsible for publishing more than 7,000 pages of top secret documents to the press back in the early 70s. The documentary of his story takes us back to one of the most tumultuous periods in American history and examines how one man can change the way this country thinks about war, patriotism, and freedom of the press. So joining us now to talk about the story of Daniel Ellsberg is Daniel Ellsberg himself, as well as Judith Ehrlich and Rick Goldsmith, the two filmmakers who told this story. Daniel, welcome back. Judith, Rick, welcome to WNYC, and congratulations on your Oscar nomination.
Thank you very much.
Good to be here.
Judith and Rick, this is a story that is so familiar to so many Americans, if they are from the baby boom generation and many others who are younger as well or older. Why tell it again in a 2009 movie?
Well, I think that it's not as familiar as people might think. Anybody who's under the age of 55, we are finding out, doesn't know the story, hasn't heard the name of Daniel Ellsberg, and probably only has a sketchy knowledge of the war in Vietnam. And we're finding that people of our generation and older do remember the events, but not that well, and we've uncovered a lot more now. But to get to the heart of your question, the parallels between America then and America now, embroiled in two wars, are just unmistakable. And I think there are a lot of lessons to be learned from this story.
Daniel, do you want to pick that up and talk about lessons to be learned from your experiences then for today?
Well, that was very well said by Rick, and I do agree with him. Most people who are reacting to the film, even friends of mine actually, are commenting on how much either they had never known or had forgotten and didn't know about the story. So it's, and what he said about the currency of it, let me speak for them a minute, what I've heard. I think they did not expect when they started on this that they would have a film that would be as timely as, unhappily, it is a year after George W. Bush had left office. I think they felt the analogy was especially with Iraq, and that a new president would at least give people the impression that that was closing down. As it is, we are, by decision of President Obama, heading into a war that, from my experience and my study of these problems and my judgment as to who's giving us the right story about it now, is as hopeless, as unnecessary, as dangerous, really, as the war in Vietnam, and for very many of the same reasons, that this is going to be a war that's going to be very hard to end. It offers no hope of success. And once again, as in Vietnam, we are confronting people who have spent literally thousands of years. That sounds like an exaggeration, but that's their self-image with a lot of reality, that since the time of Alexander the Great in the case of Afghanistan, they have been successfully resisting foreign occupation, and that's what they're doing right now.
I want to play a clip from the documentary. This is from Daniel's wife, Patricia, reacting to reading the Pentagon Papers for the first time.
He gave me a number of the papers to read, and as I was reading it, I was horrified by the coldness, the calculatedness, and in particular the language of the torturers. They were quotes saying, "We'll give the North Vietnamese one more turn of the screw," or "Let's try the water drop technique." And I was thinking, what is this? How can the leaders of our country be talking in this language and then misleading the American public?
So again, that from the Oscar-nominated film, nominated for Best Documentary, about Daniel Ellsberg, which is just out the most, or which was out in 2009, The Most Dangerous Man in America, Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers. And Daniel, that was enough to give me chills, hearing the references to torture and thinking about how that has been such a current debate in the 2000s. And there it was in the 1970s in a way that a lot of people today probably didn't even think of.
Well, that's right. You know, she wasn't, the context of that quotation was she was really reading about the bombing program of North Vietnam, which as she read it, and she was virtually the first woman ever to read these documents, except for secretaries who had typed them. But the first woman who had really looked at the content of those messages. And what she was seeing was that the program that I had been involved in, even as an internal critic, I didn't think the bombing was the right thing approach for us to be using. Nevertheless, I was part of the campaign that was doing that. And she perceived it as torturing a country. Those were the terms that she was using. Now, actually, literal face-to-face torture of prisoners was going on to a degree that I didn't know, and the Pentagon Papers don't really bring out at that time, too. Several of our most decorated soldiers in Vietnam, Colonel Anthony Herbert and Colonel David Hackworth, quit the Army in disputes over in their resistance to the torture of Vietnamese, South Vietnamese, that was actually going on. But what she was referring to was torturing a nation in the large to coerce it into submission. And they were using the same terms very casually.
Yes, and I believe Hackworth at the time was the most decorated single troop in the American Armed Forces. So we have Daniel Ellsberg with us for another few minutes, as well as the makers of this film, nominated for Best Documentary, Judith Ehrlich and Rick Goldsmith. And Judith, I'm curious, with the parallels to at least the Iraq War that are constant throughout the movie, they were allowed to remain unspoken. And certainly in Daniel, you had a voice who could draw these parallels because he's done so in his writing and his commentary many times in recent years. He's been on the show to do that. Why not say it outright in the film?
We didn't feel like we needed to. We felt like it was stronger to let people draw that conclusion themselves, and they certainly do immediately. Even the young people we've shown it to have clearly seen the resonance with the current situation without us having to spell it out. So we do hint at the end of the film to Daniel and Patricia's resistance to war and Dan currently, and we see them being arrested on Market Street in San Francisco at the end of the film. But we don't go into the 79 times that Dan has been arrested for civil disobedience against war, and we don't go into the specifics of either Afghanistan or Iraq. For one reason, we wanted it to be more less timely and more timeless, and the film would stand on its own as a historical moment rather than looking at the current moment. But we didn't feel we needed to, and it turns out we don't. People get it without us telling them.
Let's play another short clip from the Oscar-nominated film, The Most Dangerous Man in America, Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers, in which, Daniel, you are being interviewed directly after the collapse of the Nixon government, or the government case against you, I should say. You were asked at the time, what did we learn from the entire process of the Pentagon Papers?
I think one thing that people will conclude when they read it is that they have not asked enough. They have not expected enough or demanded enough in the way of boldness, in the way of responsibility from their public servants. Make that known, and I think that our Constitution will continue to function better than it has been in the past.
Not enough expectations of our public servants. So, Daniel, is that a lesson that we learned, or do we as a country, in your opinion, need to learn it again?
Actually, we did learn it pretty well for a few years, and that's the way things go. It's been almost 40 years now, and now even the lessons of the Iraq War, I think, are not being applied as we go into Afghanistan. You know, the clip with which you started the program by Nixon, where he actually said that Daniel Ellsberg, that I had put myself above the president and Congress and our whole system of government in deciding what the public should know. That's really a laugh, because the classification of the Pentagon Papers was above all to keep that information from of the president from Congress. And the lowest secretary or clerk in the Defense Department, let's say, knew information about our decision-making that no member of Congress, however senior, was allowed to know. Your last quote, I think, does give a lesson that does apply very much today. We can't follow President Nixon's notion, on the one hand, that only the president should decide what the Congress and the courts and the public should know. That's a recipe for monarchy, if you like, or tyranny, or one-man rule. And the effect of that is wars like Vietnam and Iraq and Afghanistan, and possibly in our future, Yemen and Somalia and others. We, the people, do need to ask our Congress to live up to their constitutional responsibilities, to take responsibility for the decision of whether to go to war and under what conditions and why. They really have unconstitutionally delegated that to the president, and they've allowed themselves to be blinded and deafened by the president, to be ignorant of most of what they ought to know to make policy.
We're just about out of time, and as I said, this is the beginning of a series we'll be doing in this time slot. All this week through Thursday, we'll be profiling four of the nominated films for Best Documentary Oscar. Of course, the Oscars this Sunday night. This documentary, The Most Dangerous Man in America, Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers. And Rick, Judith, you want to give us a closing word here? Maybe what's at stake? Do you campaign for Best Documentary? Or if you win, what does it do for the for you and for the message?
Well, I think that we're thrilled to get the story out to a larger public, whether it's the nomination or the win. It's great. And just that we're at this week, assessed by the major American film critics as the number one film in the United States, and Avatar is number 10. We think we've got the real Avatar in our film.
Rick, give us a last word.
Well, I think that the more people that can get to see this film, the better, because I think it has an important message. It has an important message about today, about war and peace, and about democracy.
Can I add, I think the message is, as I hear it, that courage is contagious, that we need more truth-telling, more civil courage in this country if we're ever to get out of our endless war in Afghanistan and Iraq. And that we need the Pentagon Papers of Afghanistan and Iraq right now.
Filmmakers Judith Ehrlich and Rick Goldsmith, Daniel Ellsberg himself, subject of The Most Dangerous Man in America, Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers, nominated for Best Documentary at the Oscars. Thank you all very much for coming on with us.
Thank you
very much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Again, we will continue all this week through Thursday at this time, profiling Best Documentary nominated films. And coming up next, we begin another series on the five biggest myths about the census and the U.S. population with James Frey from The Washington Post. We'll find out what his myth number one is about the census and the U.S. population coming right up. Stay with us.